All right, Brian, how are you?
Charles, it's so good to see you again.
It's been a long time.
It's been a long time. Been busy. Got some nice things to...
To talk about?
Well, you know, let me put it to you this way. The thing that I've been working on for the last couple of years has been deployed.
Okay.
All I can say to you is that it's not available to customers outside Microsoft yet.
Okay.
But it has been put into work, and it's just possible that somewhere along the way, in your travels through the internet, that you may have run through this thing.
Excellent.
You may have received some results that were pushed through our little team's creation.
Excellent. Now, does it contain like monadic structures?
You know, since I'm a one-trick pony, I can't say that it does or it doesn't, but you can use your imagination.
Excellent. So, hey, the reason I'm here today is because I got this interesting email from Eric.
Yes.
With a link to Lambda to Ultimate. Of course, you were on the email as well.
Yes.
And it linked to some really interesting, fascinating video about an analog computer, which spurned some ideas in your head. So,
What it did was it brought back a flood of memories that I told Eric about. And I have kind of an unusual background. I don't talk about myself very often. But... It brought back a flood of memories that were associated to this link. So I'm going to show you the link and what we were talking about.
Okay.
And then tell you about some of the stories, because I told the stories to Eric, and Eric said, you know, you really ought to tell these stories to the Channel Niners, because this is way out there.
Awesome.
So let me begin with the hook.
Okay.
My dad was a well-known TV actor.
Really?
My dad's name he died a couple of years ago. His name was Henry Beckman.
Henry Beckman.
You can look him up on IMDb, the Internet Movie Database. He's got about 3,000 credits to his name.
No. 3,000?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. He was a well-known TV actor in the 60s and 70s.
Excellent.
And worked even deep into the 90s.
Science fiction, maybe?
No, he was, if you know Rod Steiger.
Yes.
My dad competed against Rod Steiger all the time. They battled over parts constantly.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
So he's a... big, brash character actor. Played a lot of Southern cops and, you know, tough guys and things.
Wow. Yeah. I'm psyched to check this out.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. So let's take a look at the link on Lambda.
So if you went to Lambda the Ultimate and you went into this little search box over here and you typed something like analog with no GUE, just analog computers. I'll just say analog computers. You would get a few. And you get this one here called analog computing. Now that's the fourth one down today. Lambda changes all the time. This is from Edward Lam. A set of two amazingly detailed U.S. Navy films explaining the basic mechanics in fire control computers. I clinked this, thanks to Eric. Excuse me here. And somewhere there was a nice little movie here.
I think there's a link. Part 1 and part 2 in the text.
Ah, there we go. Yes. Ah. Beautiful. Thank you. Oh, my gosh. The instant I saw this, I said, oh, no, I don't believe what I'm seeing. So I'm going to put it on pause. I don't want to spoil this. Everyone should watch it. These are great movies.
Okay.
Okay, so here's the flood of memories this brought back. My dad also had a little movie production company, as did so many Hollywood people. And he made contract movies for the Navy.
Huh.
Now, he didn't make... contract movies about analog computing, but I have another flood of memories that's going to bring that back. But he did make United States Navy training films. Most of the ones that he made were about aircraft carrier safety.
Interesting.
So he would bring, when I was a little kid, he would bring home these film reels with these horrible accidents on aircraft carriers. And the most memorable one to me was a jet came in, and the biggest problem with aircraft carriers is the deck is pitching up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And the plane is coming in, and it's trying to figure out how it's going to hit this deck with the minimum amount of, contact force. Well, this one hit really hard. The deck came up at the same time the plane came down, and it busted off the nose wheel. And it had a long stock, you know, the nose wheel shaft, started scraping along the deck. And this nose wheel shaft is made of pure magnesium, which burns very, very hot. 2,500, 3,000 degrees, I don't know, some huge number. So you get this white flash as the thing ignites, and it burns freely. And it's spewing hot sparks at very high temperature off on everything on this deck, setting stuff on fire as it's scraping down the deck. Mm. It eventually goes off the end into the drink and extinguishes. But now the poor crew has on this heaving deck in rough seas has this fire to take care of, and it was just a don't try this on your aircraft carrier.
Yes, exactly.
And he had dozens of these things. Okay, but this particular pair of films that, and I have another Hollywood connection to tell you about. Let me do that one first.
Yeah,
and then we'll get rid of the Hollywood, and then we can go into the analog community.
I would have never guessed Hollywood connection, but actually, yes, I would. So continue, right on.
Yeah, it's just, it's in the blood.
Time Warp OS.
Time Warp OS, all of it.
Amazing. Right,
my wife lived across the street from a strange thing in the Hollywood Hills. And when we were growing up, we all knew that there was this strange place over there, but we didn't know what it was. There was a gate around it and little, barbed wire and things. And it's up in the middle of absolutely nowhere in the Hollywood Hills. If you didn't know where this was, you'd never run across it.
Hmm.
But it turns out that it was a secret movie lab. It's 7 or 8 stories deep. In the 70s or 80s, it was run by the Air Force, and they created all the Trinity bomb movies there. Now, if you've ever seen the Trinity bomb movie series, if you go look for the Trinity Project or something, you see all these atom bomb movies where they filmed all of the tests of the big nukes, the 50 megaton thing, the Bikini
Wow.
Atoll nukes, and they did dozens, if not hundreds, of tests.
Okay.
And all those films were deeply classified. And many of them are incredibly fascinating if you care about atomic and nuclear physics. Mm. You can actually see in some of these, super slow-mo explosions, you can see the pattern of the igniters on the fission and fusion material actually reflected in the fireballs. Absolutely fascinating.
Interesting.
They were all developed in that little studio.
Huh.
In the 70s or 80s, the Air Force sold it off, and a bunch of hippies bought it, and now it's this house that
really
is 7 or 8 stories underground.
Oh, awesome!
It's thousands of square feet. It was a secret movie studio during World War II and the Cold War. Secret Cold War movie studio, right there near where I grew up, and my wife happened to live across the street.
Excellent.
Like a lot of people, I married somebody who lived, three or four miles away from me. Anyway, so much for Hollywood. We get to another story. My uncle gave me something when I was a kid. So when I watched this movie here on these analog computers, this fire control computer, and you watch it, you'll see gears and shafts and cam plates with cam followers and rollers and little balls that follow these rollers. And I remember this thing. My uncle gave me a bomb sight. My uncle was a World War II bomber pilot.
Okay.
And he gave me a bomb sight that they had stripped off of one of the crashed or ruined or mothballed, I don't know. I don't remember the story very exactly. I barely remember the thing. Mm. But I remember looking inside of it, and the way this thing worked was you would put your eyes in it. It had a prism, and he showed me how it worked. And he taught me calculus off of this thing when I was 8 or 9 years old.
Wow.
Yeah. He taught me the basic principles of it, if you have a function and you integrate the function, the rate of change of the integral is actually equal to the value of the function, because as you're multiplying the function by these little increments,
mm-hmm.
what you're adding to the integral, the rate of change of what you're adding to the integral is exactly the function itself. That's the meaning of the fundamental theorem of calculus. It's bidirectional. That the opposite of an integral is a derivative, and the
yes.
opposite. And I knew this. I learned this right away from
wow.
my uncle telling me how this bomb sight worked. But this thing was absolutely fascinating. It was loaded with gears and shafts and little balls and its cam followers. This is the thing that triggered the memory when I saw these cam followers that you'll see in here. This thing had inside of it a model for the physics of a bomb falling.
Hmm.
And what are the physics of a bomb falling? Well, first of all, the airplane is moving at some speed. The only thing you can measure is the speed of the airplane with respect to the air. So you have to have some model for the air speed, and how that reflects to ground speed. So you have to have some measure of the wind. Mm. Well, this bomb site had little places where you would lock in cables that would come from measuring devices somewhere else in the airplane. There's an airspeed device, an altitude device, and some kind of wind measurement device. Mm. It would come in, and the angle of the cable, the twist of the cable, would denote what's the airspeed, what's the altitude. You plug this into the back of this thing, literally like bicycle cables, you know, like brake cables on bicycle. It's exactly what it looked like. Snap these things in there, and then it would do calculations in real time. You would, there were some knobs on the side where you could set constants. Maybe the temperature, I don't know. There were a bunch of knobs on the outside of the thing. It was a big block of metal about this big, with wings on it where the gears and shafts and so on were all working. And you would look inside of it, and the big knob, you would try to put the reticle on the target. You'd see the target, mm-hmm. and you'd put the reticle on there. Meanwhile, this calculator with all the gears and shafts and cam followers in there, it's calculating, it's got a model in there of how the wind resistance is going to slow down the bomb as it's falling. So the plane is moving along like this. The bomb comes out, and the bomb doesn't go as fast as the plane. It gets slowed down by wind resistance. Well, that's 1/2 rho CD V squared. Rho is the density of the atmosphere, and that's affected by temperature, mm-hmm. which is going to be one of these little cam followers. It's got a function, a temperature function that tells you what rho is. And altitude, we've got another little cam follower. And so all these things are put together through a multiplier thing. You're going to see all this stuff in these videos. You're going to see the multiplier. You're going to see the integrator. So meanwhile, this thing is calculating in real time just by running little tangs inside cam, little cams, amazing. Inside cam followers, and calculating in real time the solution to this problem, which is going to tell you when and where that bomb is going to hit. And the user interface was, it would just add some tilt to this prism in there that's affecting how you can see it. So all you, to operate the thing, you just line up the reticle on the target, and then you have some sort of thing where it's, there's a little line and the target comes into this thing, and as soon as it crosses that line, bam, you hit the button and drop the bomb.
Amazing.
Really, really something.
Purely analog.
Purely analog. So he gave this to me, and he explained to me roughly how it worked, and explained to me the mathematical principles, and we had many, many lovely hours working on this kind of
thing. So now let's, you know, since we're talking about some Beckman history.
Yeah.
Is this when you first got into mathematics, or was this earlier?
I was kind of born that way.
You were born that way.
Yeah. The earliest story, see, you got me talking about myself now.
That's good. This is about Beckman history.
My mom used to tell a story. My mom was the youngest of nine, and she took me when I was a little tyke back to Texas, where the extended family is. And put me down on the floor and showed me off to all of her sisters. She had 7 sisters.
Wow.
Yeah. And she put a giant jar of buttons in front of me. And the sisters said, "Don't do that. He's only 1 1/2. He'll eat them and choke on them." And she said, "No, he won't. He'll sort them." Which is exactly what it is. I sat there and I took him out of the thing and piled it. She didn't have any pictures of it. But she told that story for...
That's
so
awesome.
So I would just sort them by color, by size. You know, just take them out there.
Perfect.
So I was kind of born that way. This was the bomb sites that my uncle gave me in those lovely hours we spent. He also had all his navigation equipment, dead reckoning equipment, where you could do your navigations without instruments. And he explained to me how all that stuff works. So by the time I was 9 or 10 years old, I had a really good grip on the basics of math. So now there's another story.
All right.
This was in the 60s. How do I know it was in the 60s? Because it was a math camp at Exposition Park in Los Angeles. And okay. It was middle of the summer, and the windows were open. And Barbara Streisand was out in the road garden screaming, "On a clear day, you can see forever." And she must have sung this song 40,000 times.
No, literally?
She was out, there's a movie, I think it's called It's Funny Girl, where she sings this song in the Rose Garden of Exposition Park.
Ah.
So it was whatever summer that movie was being made, I don't know, it was 67 or 68.
Amazing.
That's how I know when, I could look it up, but she sang that, this was a 6-week math summer camp, and she sang that song all day, every day, for 6 weeks, in 100-degree weather.
Wow.
And she would sing for 20 seconds and then stop. And then 45 minutes would go by and she'd sing for 20 seconds and then stop. And I guess she just wanted to be perfect. I don't know.
Yeah.
She was kind of...
So do you have a lot of Barbara Streisand albums then?
Yeah, right. She's my favorite.
Excellent. So math
Let me put it this way. I know everything about On a Clear Day You Can See Forever. So it was just math camp. And one of the things we did at math camp was we learned how to do square roots in longhand.
Okay.
And then one day, the teacher said, I have a very special guest for you. And she brought in this funny little man with this big pile of hair and this very thick Brooklyn accent.
Yeah, yeah.
And he said, now your teacher has told you how to do square roots. I'm going to show you a better way to do it. And he said, first, you take a guess for the square root. Say you want the square root of 6. You take a guess for the square root, say 3. Now you know 3 is too big because 3 squared is 9. That's too big. So take the average of 6 divided by 3 and 3, your guess. Take the average of your guess and of your target number divided by your guess. And that's going to give you another number. That's going to be 6 divided by 3 is 2, and 3, average of the 2 is 2.5. That's a lot closer to the square root of 6 than 3 was. Mm-hmm. And you keep doing this over and over again. 2 or 3 steps, you got square root close enough, and it's a whole lot easier than okay, you get the idea?
Yes.
Now, much later in life, I didn't know who this funny little guy was, but much later in life, I found out that Richard Feynman was renowned for this particular trick. This happens to be an application of Newton's method for finding the root of any function. So if you think of finding the square root of 6 is the same as finding the root of the equation x squared minus 6 equals 0. And then you just plug this into Newton's method, which looks like the function evaluated at your guess divided by the derivative of the function divided at your guess. This is something you get by solving a linear equation, shooting the tangent, the linear function. Remember linear approximations from covariance and contravariance?
Yeah.
By the way, we are going to finish this.
Are we going to finish that?
The ball's in Eric's court.
I hear you. Well, you guys have been phenomenally busy.
Yeah.
So everyone out there knows.
I'm ready. We're waiting on Eric. And we will absolutely finish this. But anyway, linear approximation. So here I've got this square function, and I take a linear approximation. I shoot it down to the x-axis. I now have 2 points. One on the curve. So the y-coordinate of that one is x squared minus 6. Okay. The x-coordinate of that one is x0, my guess. So this is x0 squared minus 6. And then the other point I have, the y-coordinate is 0, because I'm looking for the root of this equation. And the x-coordinate is whatever my new guess is. And I'm going to find that one. Well, I know the slope of this tangent line from the derivative. The slope of the tangent is the multiplication factor. It is the best linear approximation to the function at that point. So I have one equation and one unknown. The one unknown is the x-coordinate of my thing. And I can solve that. And it turns out to be, in the case of square root, it's the average of the target number divided by the guess, and your guess gives you the better guess. In the case of cube root or other functions, it's a different trick. But Feynman was renowned for telling people all of these things. Mm-hmm. And later I met him again. I spent a lot of time with him because I used to spend my summers at Caltech. I went to Southern Cal as a college student and then went to Princeton as a graduate student. So I spent a lot of time with Feynman. But by gum, I can't prove that was he who had dropped into my math class, but if it wasn't he, it was a pretty good simulation of it. Because when I met him later, I said, you know, I know this guy.
Yeah. Excellent.
So that's another little Beckman story.
Now, back into the Beckman history path.
Yes.
At what point did you decide physics instead of math? So physics being an application of math, or even more theoretical in some sense, but not really. When did the whole physics thing, was it Feynman, was it...
The way I got into physics was I actually started college as an architecture student. I wanted to design buildings.
Interesting.
And I rapidly became more interested in the mechanics of the building than in the aesthetics of the building.
Okay.
I was interested in both. Mm-hmm. I became much more interested in what is it that causes a building to stand up? What are cantilevers, plates, shells, and all of this kind of stuff? And I'd already had all the, not all the math, but the math basics. Background, math basics in my back pocket. So I just fell in love with it when I found physics.
Awesome.
Because it's the same methodology applied not just to, you know, how do buildings hold together and how do vehicles move and how do bombs fall and so on, but, you know, how does everything else work?
Absolutely.
The atoms, molecules, and, you know, waves, things you can't see.
Or how does everything else work in the context of what we think we understand?
Well, yes.
Yeah. This is, I've been thinking a lot about that lately.
This is very good. This is a philosophical point.
Sure.
Yeah, it's a philosophical point. So I'll tell you my fundamental philosophical belief.
Okay.
I always say this when people say, well, you know, the world isn't, nothing in the world is black and white, it's all shades of gray. And I say, no, everything in the world is actually black and white. The only thing gray is our understanding of it.
Excellent.
So, the progress of physics is trying to find these sharp distinctions between things and kind of dispel the gray a little bit more and look for the more black and white. It's all about finding distinctions. Mm. You see things that are in the haze, they're blurry, they seem to be the same, but there's something nagging you, and you say, well, there's a distinction in here between left and right, between positive and negative, between gravity and quantum mechanics. Let me refine that distinction. Mm. And then the difference between physics and mathematics is, in physics, you try always to find something that can be tested in the laboratory. In mathematics, you draw the distinctions on purely abstract grounds. Mm. And if you've got a theory that's self-consistent and holds together, then you have a theory. And if it happens also to elucidate other theories and give you hints about other things, other unsolved problems, then you have a really great theory. Mm-hmm. And if it becomes foundations of all kinds of subjects, then you have a permanent theory. So,
true.
But I was always interested in the physical world and how the world actually works. Nowadays, the distinction between physics and mathematics is growing so thin as areas like string theory and so on. Some of these propositions will never be testable.
Okay.
You'd have to have a cyclotron the size of the Milky Way to find some of these little distinctions that the theories predict. Does it mean the theories themselves are bad? No, but it means they're not traditional physics. Mm. Traditional physics, if you can't test it, it's nonsense. It's not even worth talking about.
Sure.
Now you've got the biggest push in physics nowadays is to try to find the confluence of quantum mechanics and general relativity. Mathematically, these things don't mesh. They're not on the same foundation. Mm. Gravitation says space and time are the same kind of thing, and they're exposed to geometrical distortions according to a certain way. And quantum mechanics says, I'm trying to find the time evolution of a system. Let me take time as my fixed variable. And we know how to do special relativity with time as a, but we don't know how to do general relativity with time as an independent variable.
Interesting.
I'm not saying this exactly right, but quantum mechanics has more of a notion of Newtonian time, which means time is a thing and you relate everything to that coordinate. Whereas you relate all of your dynamical variables to that coordinate. So all your equations look like Q as a function of time.
Okay.
And there's also a function of space. But in quantum mechanics, the space variables become dual to the momentum variables. Time variable becomes dual to energy, but not in the same way, not exactly the same way. Everything still wants to snap into this dynamics framework. Whereas general relativity is a completely different view of the universe. Space and time are just coordinates in a multidimensional coordinate space. And
it's true though, right?
Yeah. If you
can they both be true?
Can they both be true? Yeah. But of course they can, in the sense that if you do an experiment, mm-hmm. One of the most embarrassing things in all of physics is the fact that quantum electrodynamics, which is a mathematically deeply flawed theory, is the most spectacularly verified theory in all of science.
Wow.
You do the Casimir effect or some of these other little tiny quantum electrodynamic measurements, you could get agreement between theory and experiment to 13 decimal places. This is a part in 10 trillion. This is astonishingly true.
Yes.
It's true-ish.
Okay.
Truth-ish, whatever the phrase is. And yet, mathematically, the theory is just, it's a pile of hacks.
Wow.
Because as soon as you write down the equations, they blow up. You get infinity. And then you try to break that apart, and you get an infinite series of infinities. And it just, it's a mess. So what do? Well, you find another infinite series of infinities, and you subtract the two, and you get the right answer to 13 decimal places. It's insanity. That's called renormalization, by the way.
Wow.
And you go to graduate school, and you spend years figuring out how to do these calculations. You learn all the hacks. And they just work.
Wow.
Nobody has any idea, really, why. And that's the whole effort of string theory and loop quantum gravity. And some of these, there are a couple of other little candidate theories floating around. I think we talked about Garrett Lisi's theory of everything a while back. That turned out not to work out, but
yeah.
Boy, that was a very pretty, very pretty idea. Still is a pretty idea. I don't know what the current status of it is.
Sure. And then, of course, you moved into astrophysics. And by the way, as you know, it's the 50th anniversary of the Drake Equation.
Oh, my gosh.
It's the 50th anniversary.
Well, I'm going to have a nice piece of cake. and I'm going to put on the cake 10 to the minus 600. It's the 10 to the minus 600th birthday of the Drake Equation, right?
Well, it's interesting because the thing that I find most interesting about the Drake Equation, besides of its sort of rather unbelievable assumptions and even pretension, is that many of the core components of the equation are in and of themselves almost impossible for us to determine values for accurately because, you know, all the number of intelligent civilizations in a figure that is that. The number of them, it's like, okay. So I just wanted to get, you know, this is an important data. Look, the search for life is the single most important thing for humanity.
It's huge.
So, what are your thoughts on the Drake Equation and life in the universe? What's going on?
Oh, heck, I don't know. I can't claim to know anything more than anybody else. It does seem to me that life is highly improbable, and that we may be in an accidental place of one.
Hmm.
It may be. Hmm. It that does not strike me as intuitively impossible. Yes, there are 100 billion galaxies, and yes, there are 100 billion stars in every galaxy, and yes, there are a lot of numbers. There's a lot of stuff in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
But life is really, really hard to develop. I mean, look at all the little steps that are required to, you know, they're all spelled out in the Drake. Conceptually, he's got the right factors there.
Yes.
We just can't evaluate any of these numbers with any certainty. By the time you multiply two or three of the factors together, the uncertainty is much larger than the value you're getting.
Sure.
So it's just it's a numerical problem. But, boy, it just seems like a chain of causation.
Mm-hmm.
You got to be incredibly lucky that each one of these things happened at just the right time and place and that nothing came along to wipe it out.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's true.
Seems to me to be an awful lot of luck. Now, the fact that it's compatible with the laws of physics is demonstrated by the fact that we're here. So that I'm going to argue the other side now, right?
Yeah.
Like any good...
good. Well, it's easy to make the case for the one.
Yeah.
That's all we have evidence.
Because the case for the one is proof. Here we are.
Hey, now, how's it going?
Dude!
We're here.
Is the proof, right?
Yes, totally. Dude is the proof. It's interesting, though. Do you remember the anthropomorphic principle before you get into
the anthropic principle?
The anthropic principle,
yes,
sorry.
Yes.
That's also an interesting one. The universe needs to be as large and old and complex as it is. It's really a cop-out.
It's a tautology.
Yeah.
It is.
For something like us to develop, right?
Sure.
That's basically what the...
Yeah, and I think there's some deeper content to it might be, if the laws of physics were even slightly different than they actually are, we wouldn't be here. There wouldn't be any us to be talking about it.
True.
And that's maybe adds a little more meaning to it.
So now on the other side, you argued for the one.
Yeah.
Not the mistake of one, but let's say the random of one.
The chain of great luck that's required. The chain of great luck that's required for the one to be.
Okay.
And to argue for the other,
mm-hmm.
the fact that the laws of physics are compatible with life is proved by the fact that we're here, and therefore, since the laws of physics are the same everywhere and every when, or at least we have great evidence that that's true, because you look at the distant galaxies and the same atomic processes are happening in the stars and the distant galaxies with the same time constants. So to a very great extent, the laws of physics are the same everywhere and everywhere. They might have been different in the time of inflation and so on. I've got my own problems with that theory. But for 16 billion years, the laws of physics have not changed in the universe. And it's compatible with life. Mm-hmm. Could it happen somewhere else? Absolutely. It happened here, so of course it could happen somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Until we find the second instance, we have no ability to calculate the probability, though. Because to do the probability, you have to have to divide by n minus 1. Mm-hmm. And n minus 1 is 0. You can't divide by 0, so you can't calculate a standard deviation to measure the likelihood of life by a standard deviation until you have at least two instances.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we'll find that. I mean, I think Europa is interesting.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting. As is Titan. I don't think we should give up on Titan.
No. No, they're good, great places to look in the solar system, and there's a heck of a lot of real estate to look around outside of the solar system.
So one other interesting theory could be that, and this goes back to Lovelock's theory of Gaia,
yeah,
which is essentially life is essentially just a geophysical property.
Right.
It's a geologic property of a rocky planet,
yeah,
our form. So
yes,
we actually are, in some sense, we are from where we are found. And what I mean by that is we developed where we are found.
Okay,
so
yeah, right.
We emerged with the evolution of this planet, and we
yeah.
think we know how planets evolve, but it could very well be that planets also have lifespans. Mars is an obvious example, right? They're pretty dead geologically, blah, blah, blah.
A lot of the atmosphere is blown off, and water's gone. It used to be there.
It used to be water, used to have atmospheres. So perhaps life can only get to a technological capability to leave a planet and move around and shoot enough information out everywhere that we're held back by because how long the planets listen. Maybe that could be sort of just the universe's kind of grand trick.
Yeah.
You figured out that you're in the universe. Good job. You're almost done.
Right.
But
oh, I like that. That's really good.
But that could be... I don't know what we'd
You're almost done. Now got to try to figure out how to spread it around.
Totally. We're trying.
Yeah.
We're trying the Mars mission and stuff.
Yeah.
So back to analog computing.
Okay.
Take this back.
All right. You know, rather than spoil it, I got to send you to watch these things. These are... this is high art. You are guaranteed you're going to love this.
Okay.
There are other kinds of analog computers. I have... use some that are built out of resistors and capacitors and discrete components, not digital components, but discrete components. And then you can emulate mechanical systems with those things because there's a deep analogy between the equations, circuit equations, and the equations of mechanics, springs and dashpots.
Okay.
So, for example, you can simulate an automobile rolling down the road with a little tunable, you know, essentially a transistor radio.
Mm.
The equations are profoundly similar. And then, of course, the little pepper grinder that I showed you in one of the very first movies that we did.
Yeah, Brief History of Computing.
That is a digital mechanical computer. That's digital because it produces exact results, but it is mechanical. So it's not the same as an analog computer. An analog computer produces approximate numerical results.
Ah,
yes. Okay. Using... physical systems that mimic the equations you're trying to solve. So in the case of these things, the fire control, and in the case of the little bomb sight that my uncle gave me, the equations being solved are represented by the shapes of rollers and cones and cams. And so there's you'll see spiral cuts in cams. That's simulating a particular function. And you'll see shapes of rollers, that, and some little gadget travels along that roller, that's simulating some other function. And then gear ratios gives you a kind of a digital component there, because those are always going to be in the exact numerical ratios, but they're meant to approximate real numbers.
Mm.
And then the ones made out of discrete electrical components, capacitors and resistors and so on, those are also simulating differential equations with approximate physical gadgets. So that's the difference between an analog computer and a digital computer. The little pepper mill, or an adding machine, in fact, is a digital computer built out of mechanical components. And then the digital computers that we use every day are digital computers built out of electrical components. And digital electronic components. And the proof is there have things in there called barrel shifters. Hmm. Well, those are things for shifting bits in and out. That's directly borrowed from the technology of shifting barrels in adding machines.
Interesting, yes.
So when when von Neumann and pals were inventing digital computers, they were using the mechanical computers as an analog. The joke is going all back and forth on this. Using them as analogs to help them design the digital components that they needed to do digital computing.
Interesting. Now let me ask you a quick question before we wrap this up, because I know you're very busy. Von Neumann's design, what do you think in terms of how processes are designed? This is a very random question, but it is relevant to what we keep talking about and sometimes even pimping, you know, in the loose term on Channel 9 about the concurrency problem,
blah. It's the big problem.
Yeah, I mean, it could very well. Would you argue that perhaps the very architecture of computers were designed not with dealing with highly concurrent systems in a general purpose world?
Right.
Is that true or not true? What's your thoughts on that?
I think there's a continuum of systems that are... On one extreme, you have very coarse-grained parallelism, where each individual computing component is a serious computer, like a von Neumann computer, and then you connect them together in networks. Mm-hmm. That I call that coarse-grained parallelism. I'm not the only one. I've by no means invented any of this terminology.
Okay.
And then fine-grained parallelism is represented by things like neural networks, where each computing component is incredibly dumb. It may even be just a switch. Mm. And you can connect these things in huge networks. And then an extension of that is field-programmable gate arrays, which a lot of people are very excited about because you can bake in concurrent algorithms in an otherwise general-purpose dumb network.
Excellent. I read something.
So there's kind of a... Yeah, there are a lot of people who love these things. I've not looked into them deeply myself, but just from a theoretical standpoint... You go all the way from one to the other. The Time Warp operating system was built on the assumption of very coarse-grained parallelism. Mm-hmm. The individual nodes are powerful computers, and we put a lot of them together and make them work and coordinate their activities. The neural networks is maybe the cleanest example of fine-grained parallelism. And that was meant as an ersatz imitation of how people think the human mind might work, because the individual processing nodes in the human brain are pretty dumb. They just get some inputs and they either fire or don't fire. They're a switch, and the intelligence presumably comes from a networking effect of just having literally a trillion of these things all interconnected in strange and wondrous ways.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And so for the last question, this is going to be of extreme randomness, but I was walking around in my backyard this weekend.
Yeah.
Whether or not I had wine or not is independent of what I was thinking about.
Wine is a necessity of life.
It is a necessity. Yes. I was looking up, because it was actually, there was a rare clearing in the winter sky.
Yes.
And I said to myself, wait a minute, this is my land, right? So I have the fence is my property mark.
Right.
But that's only two dimensions. I want to know how high my land goes.
Yeah.
So how much, when you buy a piece of property, how high is it? What is the...
That's an excellent question.
The z-axis.
I have heard that it goes up forever, but it might vary from state to state. You know, individual states in the U.S. might have different...
Interesting.
And of course, if you're in the United Kingdom, you don't own it at all. You only lease it from the Queen. So...
Interesting.
For 999 years or whatever.
Okay.
So it varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction is the slippery answer out of that one.
Excellent. Well, hey, Brian, always great to talk to you.
Always a pleasure.
And we will point people to this. I'm going to zoom in this again.
You're going to love
and
this,
we'll give them the link on Lambda the Ultimate, which is a great site.
There are two of them, and they're just great.
Perfect. And we'll come back and talk to you. Now, for people in the audience who have been asking, when are you going to go talk to Brian about what he's working on? What is Brian's secret project? Unfortunately, it's still secret.
Yes.
But the fact is, as you said, it's deployed.
It has been deployed. It is successful.
It is successful.
It is successful. It is very successful. It's working. It's real. I just can't tell you a whole lot about it.
That's fine, but when you can, we'll be the first ones.
We do have plans for it to be released to the public as a product. Mm-hmm. Those are the plans that are kind of in development. We don't know exactly how to realize this thing, but we do have plans.
Well, I mean, let's be honest. Not everything needs to be a platform for general purpose development. It could just be, you know, when you think about some algorithms that say companies will use and
well, let me say it'll be better than Clippy.
Excellent. On that note, take care.
Okay.
Perfect.